Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. In a series of high-profile television appearances Sunday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is addressing the American public for the first time since signing off on an Iran nuclear deal last week. Kerry said the agreement, which culminated from months of talks between top diplomats of seven countries, likely won't restart diplomatic relations with Tehran. A visit by the secretary to Iran is not contemplated, according to Kerry, in an ABC news program this week. "We don't have relations at this point," he added. The accord followed several rounds of intense negotiations between Iran and six world powers to limit Tehran's atomic program for civilian use. Ahead of President Barack Obama's visit to the region, which starts later this week, Kenyan and Ethiopian troops operating in Somalia have launched a new military offensive against the Al-Shabaab militant group in the Gedo and Bay regions. The African Union mission in Somalia, known as AMISOM, announced the offensive, named Operation Juba Corridor, and says the aim is to flush out the terrorist group from rural areas. The first phase of the two offensive was launched on Friday and near a military base run by Kenyan troops in the Gedo region. Troops had reached Tarako, 50 kilometers west of Bahardir town, on Sunday. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari Sunday begins a four-day visit to Washington, where he will hold talks with U.S. President Barack Obama. The threat posed by the Islamic extremist group Boko Haram is expected to top the agenda when Mr. Obama welcomes the Nigerian leader to the White House Monday. The U.S. is seeking to expand assistance to Nigeria in fighting the militants who have intensified their attacks. VOA News. U.S. Defense Chief Ash Carter is headed to Israel to assess its security needs in the aftermath of last week's historic international nuclear deal with Iran. The Secretary of Defense is to meet with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has called the accord to keep Iran from developing a nuclear weapon a historic mistake, and is calling for its rejection in the U.S. Congress. Carter said in advance of the trip that he has no intention of trying to reverse Mr. Netanyahu's opposition to the PAC, but hopes to strengthen U.S.-Israeli military cooperation. Authorities in South Korea say an intelligence official who apparently committed suicide left behind a note that denies the government spied on its citizens. The National Intelligence Service agent, identified by Yonhap News Agency as a man in his mid-40s named Lim, was found in his car on a mountain road in the city of Yongin, located south of Seoul. Taiwanese voters next year are all but sure to elect a woman as their next president. The ruling Nationalist Party Sunday picked Taiwan's deputy legislative speaker and a former teacher as their candidate. She will run against the opposition party's chairwoman, Tsai Ing-wen, in the January election. Ralph Jennings has details in this report from Taipei.
The Taiwan ruling Nationalist Party's first female presidential nominee will compete in the January 2016 election with a woman picked earlier this year by the chief opposition party. The opposition Democratic Progressive Party candidate Tsai Ing-wen ran for the office in 2012, but against the man who is today's president, Ma Ying-jeou. She is running now against the Deputy Speaker of Parliament, Hong Xiu-ju. Women have become heads of state in India and South Korea, among other Asian countries, but never in Taiwan. Philip Yang, spokesman for the Nationalist Candidates Campaign, said Taiwan stands out already because two women are competing. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
British Prime Minister David Cameron says his country needs to take a greater role in destroying the Islamic State group in Syria. Appearing Sunday on the NBC news program Meet the Press, Mr. Cameron said, "We know that we have to defeat ISIL. We have to destroy this caliphate, whether it's in Iraq or Syria. That is a key part of defeating this terrorist scourge we face." Britain's military said last week its forces have conducted airstrikes on Syria when embedded with coalition forces. Officials say a series of Sunday morning blasts rocked a Gaza district, wounding two people and destroying at least five cars belonging to Hamas and Islamic Jihad militants. Authorities say the explosions targeted the Sheikh Radan neighborhood, which is a Hamas stronghold. So far, there's no immediate claim of responsibility. However, pictures at the scene of one of the blasts showed the Islamic State group's flag planted on a wall. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We do not think that the talks were aimed at resolving issues only related to the elections that we are going to have next week.
Burundian Foreign Minister says the withdrawal of opposition candidates will not affect the upcoming presidential election.
As you recall, we had the update of the National Voters Register, in which new people of voting age had to register.
The Ugandan Electoral Commission plans to publicly display the voters' register on Wednesday to allow prospective voters to verify their information.
The high cost of doing business, so all those sectors are affected by the battle weekend, the performance of the economy. That's why I think the World Bank have also revised their growth forecast for this year.
And the World Bank predicts a bleak outlook of the Zimbabwean economy. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama will host Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari at the White House on Monday. It will be President Buhari's first official state visit to the U.S. since he won the March presidential election in Nigeria. The president is also expected to meet senior officials of the Obama administration, among other engagements. Garba Sheh, who is the spokesman for the Nigerian president, he joins us live via telephone link from here in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Good afternoon, Garba.
Good afternoon. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you very much. Now, let's preview the president's first state visit. What is the expectation as he visits Washington?
Well, the expectations are enormous. United States of America is the world's most important country. And Mr. Obama himself did tell the Nigerian president that, look, we are ready to support you. We're ready to sit down with you to mend what is broken of the Nigeria-U.S. relationships. Now, since the emergence of Muhammadu Buhari as president, there has been this enormous goodwill coming especially from the leading countries of the world, and in fact all over Africa and the rest of the world, that I think that the world has gotten a bit impatient with the Nigerians and wants to see change in a positive direction. And they think that President Buhari offered that best opportunity for Nigeria, you know, to break, you know, from the past and for Nigeria to begin on a new page. So our expectations are high because we're in a bit of a trouble now. You know that the Boko Haram insurgency has gone beyond the borders of Nigeria. It's been internationalized. In fact, the claim they have that they are now agents of the ISIS, I think has woken the whole world to the fact that not one single country can solve this problem.
Now Garba, in that vein, talking about security issues, there appears to be a new direction. What is the new directive since the U.S. promised to help fight Boko Haram?
Well, you know, at the moment, we are engaging with them. You know that at some point, before this new administration came on, the United States had stopped the sale of certain categories of weapons to the Nigerians on account of human rights abuses. The United States also, in fact, the relationship is such that it was almost broken. And the sense that we have is that we have come here to Washington in order that the reset button be pressed, so that the good old days between the Nigerian government and the people of the United States will be reinstated. Now, you're talking about the new methods, what new approach is there. You know that the president, on assumption of office, had directed for the movement of the command and control center from the nation's capital, Abuja, to Maiduguri. That has had the immediate effect of enhancing coordination and communication and the supply lines something that had been long expected of Nigeria, which is to engage with the neighbors. Because this thing, for some time, had become like the tennis ball. You know, we kick the insurgents into the side of our neighbors, and the neighbors kick them back into Nigeria. So without the coming together of the country, particularly of the Lake Chad Basin Commission, Niger, Chad, Cameroon, and happily being a republic has joined voluntarily, you cannot zero in and box them into a corner in order to defeat them.
Now, Garba, you President promised fighting corruption. We heard reports that the U.S. officials want to help your administration to repatriate millions of dollars siphoned out of the country. How will this be? Will this be brought up with the meeting with U.S. officials, especially with the President Obama tomorrow?
Of course, and his own officials as well. I'm sure you're aware as of now, there will be meetings with officials of Treasury Department of the U.S. government. There will be officials with the Attorney General. There will be meetings with the secret services and all of that. So, yes, the thing is, especially dealing with the theft of the Nigerian crude oil. I mean, people are looking at it, the entire world is looking at what is happening on one big screen like this. Who is stealing the crude oil, which is between 250,000 U.S. barrels up to 400,000 on a daily basis? Who is taking that crude oil? Who is the buyer? And who is pocketing the money? All of these things are seen, and the world is looking at it. So they want the Nigerian president to indicate how he wants to go about it. Do we have ideas of our own? Can we tip them? And I believe that all of these things, President Buhari has prepared very well for this meeting, and we expect that there will be not only low-hanging fruit, but in the long-term basis, we will have a situation in which perhaps this theft of Nigerian assets on a massive scale would be stopped.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Garba Shehu is the spokesman for the Nigerian President, Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with me from the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. The Burundian foreign minister says the decision of three opposition candidates to withdraw from the July 21st election is unlikely to affect the credibility of the presidential vote. Analysts say the withdrawal of the opposition presidential candidate could render the election illegitimate. But Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe told me earlier that the opposition leaders are welcome to participate in the vote.
We do not think that the talks were aimed at resolving issues only related to the elections that we are going to have next week. We believe that the talks were aimed at helping the parties to find ways of reducing the tensions that some might find in the political atmosphere in the country. And when President Museveni was here, he listed a number of principles. He said that we should negotiate expeditiously, that we shall negotiate immediately and also continuously. So that means whether we negotiate before the election or after and continue after, the key words for us are that we continue to negotiate or even those issues that we believe did not get the satisfaction of one side. There still are so many issues that need to be tackled, which have not been resolved yet. But we do not lose hope. We will continue to discuss those even after the election.
Mr. Alain Nyamitwe, some of the opposition groups as well as the civil society group says the government has showed bad faith in the talks because the government blindsided them by announcing that the elections will proceed on July 21st, despite the fact that the talks are ongoing to resolve any challenges before any elections could be held. What do you say to that?
No, I really don't think so. From my point of view, I believe that, first of all, we have to know that this particular election has been postponed this will be the second time that it was postponed. We have to agree on that because it was due to be held on the 26th of June. You remember that it was shifted to the 15th of July. And then after the summit in Dar es Salaam, it was postponed to the 21st of July. Honestly speaking, I don't think that if there was any candidate ready for election, that this date would have been an issue. Now we need to question who is with good faith and who is with bad faith. We do not want to apportion blames here. That will not solve any issue. But we believe that those who are ready would still go for the election on the 21st of July. And do not forget, we also have a constitution which sets the deadline. The minimum that we can accept is the 26th of July, because the constitution that we have currently provides that the election of the president has to take place maximum 2 months ahead the end of the tenure, and minimum a month ahead of the tenure. Now, the tenure ends on the 26th of August. A month minimum is 26th of July. Don't forget that we also have to reserve some space for a possible runoff, in case there is a runoff. Don't forget that we also need to organize a period for petitions, if there are any. So if you push beyond 21st of July, how many days do you have between 21st of July and 26th of July? It's completely impossible. Now, we also have another election scheduled on the 24th of July, which is the senatorial election, through which members of the ministerial councils will elect the senators. What do you want to do with people who keep saying no to virtually everything?
Some have said that with the three pulling out last Friday, it basically undermines the credibility of the election and says that President Nkurunziza is just going to go to an election that he will be the only person who participate, and that will really undermine the credibility of the election. And what do you say to that?
My brother, let me tell you something, that nobody has asked them to withdraw. They are invited to participate. But it is only an invitation. Participants who want to participate in the election. But I can tell you something. If they feel that their participation will change nothing as to their performance, then they need to find good excuses. They need to find good excuses.
Alain Nyamitwe is the Burundian foreign minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Bujumbura. Wednesday, the Ugandan Electoral Commission plans to begin publicly displaying its voters list to enable prospective voters to verify their information. The compiled list will be used for next year's general election, says Jotham Taremwa, spokesman for the Electoral Commission. Critics say that in previous elections, the Electoral Commission compiled non-transparent voters lists, which they said undermined the credibility of elections. But Electoral Commission spokesman Taremwa told me that for the first time, the electoral body is using new biometric measures to prevent irregularities, including vote rigging during polling.
As you recall, we had the update of the National Voters Register, in which new people of voting age had to register. So we have now to bring that data that was captured and processed into the National Voters Register to publicly put it out for verification. So the display exercise is meant to, one, ensure that you are on the register as a voter. Two, whoever is not supposed to be on that register, either on account of being underage or somebody left that area or somebody passed on, is identified and removed for cleaning it up. So we will be doing this cleanup beginning with next week, Wednesday, the 22nd of July, and close the exercise on the 11th of August this year.
What measures did the Electoral Commission implement or will be implementing to ensure the voter list that will be used for the election is transparent, credible, and acceptable to all political parties in the run-up to the election?
Before the start of the exercise, we write all the parties to alert them of the upcoming exercise and to share with them the program on how it will go. So we share that information with all the political parties in advance. Then secondly, we publicize the exercise. We go on radio, we go on TV, we send statements in the press, we meet all the stakeholders in the electoral process in form of workshops and meetings, share with them this information. Then lastly, we put it at every polling station and we inform the public to make sure that they come during that period and ask, check their particulars on the readers. And after that information has been captured of who should be included or excluded, there is a tribunal that sits and looks through those applications for exclusion and inclusion. And that tribunal is appointed by the judiciary. It is not us who appoint it. It is the other arm of government. The tribunal sits, looks through the applications, makes recommendations. But again, those recommendations are thinned out, and the public comes to verify those recommendations for at least 10 more days when they are hung there and people are coming and looking at them and ascertaining if they are correct or not.
How scientifically based will this be in terms of using the biometric system of registration and cleaning up to make it more credible and acceptable to all political parties?
First of all, before we didn't register voters using the biometric system. This time round, in preparation for the 2016 general election, we registered every voter by scanning all the 10 fingerprints, by using digital signatures, and also capturing their images. So that means that it is only one person who could register, and you could not attempt to do multiple registration at different registration centers. That will help us to make sure that it is only one person on the register. When that person votes, then he cannot attempt, because computers will be communicating with each other, show that this person already voted. So there won't be multiple voting, and there won't be impersonation. That now Peter is not around, but Tarima is around, Jotham is around, he can vote in place of Peter, because that won't be possible. So those are mechanisms in place to ensure that the voter register has the people who are supposed to be there, and on the day of voting, you only vote once, and you can't attempt to vote twice.
The opposition groups have demanded electoral reforms, including the disbandment and the reconstitution of the Electoral Commission. Now, if these demands go, they demand that, wouldn't this put a hinder to the progress that you're making? And have you taken measures to resolve this as you move forward ahead of the election?
Well, some of those reforms are genuine, some of them are not. And I don't think the solution lies in the disbandment of the commission. The solution lies in the vigilance. We have enough laws on our law books so that if everyone participated, then the election would be free and fair.
Jotham Taremwa is the spokesman for the Ugandan Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. President Obama becomes the first sitting U.S. president to visit Ethiopia, where he has this week. Obama's trip to Africa's second most populous nation comes amid growing concern that Ethiopia's government has become increasingly repressive when it comes to internal dissent. Hussein Kiflu is a social and political commentator and research associate at the Southern Methodist University, Dallas, Texas. He told my colleague Douglas Mpuga that the upcoming visit is a bit ironic.
During the long reign of Emperor Haile Selassie, Ethiopia had been a staunch ally of the United States. Although Haile Selassie's government was semi-feudal, absolute monarchy, that is far from democracy, it had nevertheless had the traditional sense of decency, also known as fear of God, which most of us Ethiopians, irrespective of our opposition to his rule, you know, as socialists, quote-unquote, as atheists, or what have you, feel very nostalgic of it today. And his government was by far the best in human, and than the military regime that replaced him and the current rulers who hailed from the bush. Yet no American president from Kennedy to Nixon, all of them were white, so Anglo-Saxon, graced Haile Selassie by paying him official visit on his domain. Ironically now, we have a black president who has heritage from Africa, closest to Ethiopia. A fact Obama himself told us is very proud of in the speech he made in Ghana. Yet he's disappointing us by lending legitimacy to one of the worst tyranny on this planet by paying an official visit to the tyrants in Ethiopia. The second ironical aspect I see in his visit to Ethiopia is in the people who are planning to host him in Addis. They were avowedly Marxist or anti-imperialist when they were in the bush during the Cold War. And so one of the imperialist powers they used to badmouth was the United States. These people were forced to change tack on the surface in the late 80s when the Soviet camp or the Eastern Bloc crumbled. And now we see them expressing pride to have managed the first sitting American president to have him on an official visit in Ethiopia. So these are the ironies. So that is how I see it, Douglas. It's a totally contrary to the speech, to the rhetoric he said in Accra.
Some analysts argue that at times it helps to visit such a kind of leaders and maybe engage with the people, point out their flaws or weaknesses. Or is it better to just ignore them? What's your take on this?
But there is a problem, you see. Again, we're coming back to the double standard. If we're talking about engaging these dictators, why doesn't United States and other Western countries do the same on Zimbabwe? You know, if we see the situation in Zimbabwe, you find that it's far better than Ethiopia. If Mugabe had even created a coalition government with his opposition. And you don't find many journalists imprisoned in Zimbabwe. And also, the Zimbabwean courts enjoy some degree of independence. In Ethiopia, these things are unthinkable. If Obama and other leaders in the Western country are, you know, their motive is primarily to engage dictators and to bring them back to a semblance of normalcy, I would have agreed with him. But that's not their primary interest. Their primary interest is what they call regional stability. And at the end of the day, that doesn't even work. That doesn't even bring regional stability. In fact, what we're seeing so far is the longer they engage these tyrants in my country, the more it backfires. That is what is happening in Somalia. The moment the late Meles Zenawi deployed his soldiers in Somalia, you know, almost the whole Somali youth enlisted to Al-Shabaab. So that is a sad situation in Ethiopia. That is what makes most of us Ethiopians angry about his upcoming visit. It's just to lend them legitimacy.
Kifulu, is that the feeling of most Ethiopians in the diaspora,
yes,
like you?
Yes. Not only in the diaspora. I mean, we are in contact with most Ethiopians in Ethiopia.
Hussein Kiflu is a social and political commentator and research associate at the Southern Methodist University. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Dallas, Texas. Moving to Southern Africa, the Zimbabwean economy looks bleak for the remainder of this year, with leading companies Econet Wireless and Delta Corporation seeking tough ways of cutting costs. This, as the World Bank predicts, the economy will grow by only 1% this year. Prosper Chitambara, the chief economist of the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe, told VOA's Zimbabwe Studio 7 reporter Blessing Zulu that the country's economy is gloomy even beyond this year.
Yeah, I think the economy has stalled. There are a lot of challenges really that are afflicting the economy. When you look at subdued domestic and foreign direct investments owing to things like liquidity crunch, owing to subdued aggregate demand, the high cost of doing business. So all those factors have affected the performance of the economy. That's why I think the World Bank have also revised their growth focus for this year.
And how significant is it that Delta is said to be considering to retrench its workers?
I think it's quite significant because Delta, for a long time, has been one of the best performing companies in the Zimbabwean economy, even on the Zimbabwe Stock Exchange. The plans by Delta to downsize, I think they actually showed the extent to which our economy, the performance of our economy is undergone. So I think it doesn't really augur well for the prospects of the economy when the companies. We also, there's the example of Econet also, that they reduced, I think, wages and adopted a number of cost-cutting measures.
Prosper Chitambara is the chief economist of the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe. He spoke with VOA Zimbabwe Studio 7 reporter Blessing Zulu from the capital, Harare. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Klote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sport with Segun Ademi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Ademi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, July 19th. Matches in the final qualifying stage of the 2015 African Under-23 Football Championship are being played across Africa this weekend. Seven matches were slated in the first leg, third round of the qualifiers. In three of the matches played on Saturday, Mali beat host Gabon 1-0, Zambia held host Ivory Coast to a goalless draw, while Egypt defeated visiting Uganda 4-0. The four remaining matches are slated for today, Sunday, with Nigeria hosting Congo, Algeria hosting Sierra Leone, neighbors South Africa and Zimbabwe clashing in Harare, and Morocco being at home to Tunisia in a regional derby. Back here in Nigeria, Sunday Olise has begun his reign as head coach of Nigeria's national team, the Super Eagles. Olise was signed on by the Nigeria Football Federation at a ceremony in the Nigerian capital, Abuja, this past week. This is coming 13 years after he captained the Super Eagles at the Africa Cup of Nations in Mali. He replaces Stephen Keshi, another former Eagles captain who was sacked by the Nigeria Football Federation 2 weeks ago. Speaking after his formal presentation, Olise said he will give his best to the job.
First of all, I'm not coming as a missile. I'm not coming as a man who knows it all. I'm not coming as someone who can singularly, alone, just turn Nigeria into Germany. But I'm coming as a man who has come to serve his country and ready to give 150%.
Olise's immediate challenge is to qualify Nigeria for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations tournament, which will be hosted by Gabon. Nigeria, a three-time Nations Cup champion, kicked off its 2017 qualifying campaign with a 2-0 victory over visiting Chad last month in the northern city of Kaduna. Talking about Olise, I spoke with sports analyst Tony Nezianya, who has been keenly following the process that led to Olise's appointment as Nigeria's head coach.
So it was something that is long overdue, that we needed to have somebody and somebody who understands the system. He's played at the highest level. He possesses a FIFA license. So I think that position has predisposed him, to the kind of coaching that Nigeria desires at this moment.
That was sports analyst Tony Nezianya speaking on new Super Eagles head coach Sunday Olise. Let's now head to Gabon, where four-time World Player of the Year Lionel Messi laid the first stone of one of the venues to be used for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations tournament. The ceremony on Saturday was witnessed by Gabonese President Ali Bongo Ondimba. It was the Barcelona star's first trip to Gabon. The Gabonese president said Messi had promised him a few years ago during a meeting in Barcelona that he would visit him in Libreville, the Gabonese capital. The Port Gentil Stadium will have a capacity of 20,000. Port Gentil is Gabon's second city and the country's oil capital. And from Brazil comes the report that soccer legend Pele has successfully undergone a back surgery and is recovering well. The Albert Einstein Hospital in Sao Paulo said Pele was hospitalized on Monday, a day before the surgery was performed. The statement did not say when the 74-year-old Pele was expected to be discharged, but some reports said he would leave the hospital this week. This is the third time Pele has been hospitalized since November. In other news, former FIFA Vice President Jeffrey Webb pleaded not guilty in a U.S. court on Saturday in connection with a massive international corruption scandal. His bail bond was set at $10 million. Webb is the first formal official of soccer's governing body to appear in a New York federal court in connection with the sweeping investigation by U.S. prosecutors that has rocked FIFA. The 50-year-old dual British and Cayman Islands citizen has surrendered his passports to the U.S. authorities and must remain within a 32-kilometer radius of the courthouse in Brooklyn. In all, 14 defendants stand accused of soliciting and receiving more than $150 million in bribes and kickbacks across 24 years. Finally, Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba broke the 1,500-meter world record on Friday with a time of 3 minutes, 50.07 seconds. Dibaba broke the record set in 1993 at the IAAF Diamond League meeting in Monaco. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Shegun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Shegun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Now you where I go send yo, because now you ain't this scatter my brain though. Yeah, yeah, I choose you for real love. Me I go hug you, love you for real love. Yeah, my sweetie, my honey. If you give me a minute, I will tell you how I'm feeling. Thank you, don't give me story, baby I am too lonely. I don't rockin' now, mommy, I don't go lie. They make my temperature rise. You are my inene girl, inene. You are my inene girl, my inene girl. I don't go lie. You they make my temperature rise. You are my inene girl, inene. You are my inene girl, my inene girl. I want to tell you something. I want to let you know, I get something for my mind, but now I want to let you know. If I'm with you, no letting go. If I'm with you, no fighting. If I stay with you, my friends see you, I they promise you no shouting. I do bad, oh, and you are sexy. There is no time, oh, baby, let's get naughty. Me, I no send, oh, wait till you tell me. I turn on you now, yeah. What me you yeah. I don't go lie. They make my temperature rise. Hey, you are my inene girl, inene. You are my inene girl, my inene girl. I don't go lie. You they make my temperature rise. Hey, you are my inene girl, inene. You are my inene girl, my inene girl.
I'm so naughty. I'm so not. Baby, please can you call me? I'm so not. I'm so naughty, naughty. Baby, please can you call me?
Come on. I'm in love with you. And that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Now that President Buhari has taken over the reins of government in Nigeria, he is confronting serious economic and security challenges. He has, of course, taken steps to move the military headquarters from Abuja to Mangere. He has also attended meetings of neighboring countries and have worked with them the setting up of a regional command center with a Nigerian at the head. But we have also heard from his assistants that they have discovered the kitty was empty when they took over the government. And quite surprisingly, they have appealed to those former officials to return money they have taken away, all the time insisting that the Buhari government will not enter into a witch hunt against the departing government. But the problem is far more than that now, because Boko Haram, faced with the strategy of the Buhari government, has now adopted a more dangerous position. It has now, it would seem, adopted the guerrilla terrorist mode. Every day now, we are hearing of hundreds of Nigerians being killed in the field, and no one knows what the end would be. We have not heard so much about even bringing about the girls that were captured. And in the circumstances, many Nigerians are beginning to wonder or to express concern that their ambitions for electing General Buhari is not being fulfilled. But terrorism really is not only related to Nigeria, and Africans should wake up and see the reality. In previous commentaries, we have mentioned terrorism in Kenya, in Uganda, and of course in Somalia. And most surprising of all is what happened in Egypt. For decades, Egypt has been a very stable society. But today, there is a threat of terrorism. Following the ousting of Morsi's government by the military, elements of the Muslim Brotherhood began to attack military outpost in Sinai, which is not well inhabited. Then they moved to Cairo and they attacked the policemen. But the prosecutor had been killed in one of the plushest areas of Cairo, Heliopolis. And this had made many Egyptians nervous. So I think Africans as a whole should be concerned about how they tackled terrorism. They do not have to wait until Boko Haram demonstrates it has a global reach. They must act now. Let's just take as an example what happened when 30 British tourists were killed in Tunisia. All of Europe was fighting. Flags were being flown half-mast all over the United Kingdom. Even mini silence in Wimbledon. Yeah, triple that number of 30 Africans are being killed every day, by terrorist group in Africa. And who are flying flags for those Africans? So I think the African Union has a responsibility. In America, there is now a slogan, Black Lives Matter. The time has come for the AU to say clearly, African life matters too. I thank you.
Thank you very much. That was one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Impuga, Producer Odette Frazier, Sports Editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the bird that remembers its flockmates never missed the way. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Some 1.2 billion people survive on less than $1.25 per day. A dollar and a quarter is the World Bank's threshold that quantifies the minimum consumption and income level needed to meet a person's basic needs. Today, that figure is widely considered to be the international poverty level, and those who live below it, about one out of every six people, or 17% of the world's population, live in extreme poverty. Extreme poverty is more than just a definition with a number attached to it. It signifies unfulfilled dreams, lost potential to the broader community, and a tough, hardscrabble life. It means a lifetime of making impossible choices when allocating scant resources between food, medicine, housing, or education, because people living at or below the poverty level spend over 80% of their income on food and are unable to save money for emergencies. Still, over the past quarter century, the situation has been improving. Since 1990, the current figure of 1.2 billion people has dropped from 1.91 billion, an improvement of 43%. And today, we believe that we can lift 1 billion more people out of poverty by 2030. With USAID leading the way, the United States, in cooperation with our international partners, has worked hard to improve economic opportunity, health, food security, education, equality, stability, and accountable governance for millions of people. Today, for the first time in history, we have the tools, technologies, and approaches to end extreme poverty by 2030. This will not be an easy task. Still, it is possible, but only if we come together as a global community in support of this effort. So we must turn existing development capacities and priorities towards ending extreme poverty by, for example, increasing food security and improving child survival and improving education. We must invite people across the world to come up with new ideas and innovative solutions to old and persistent development challenges. And we must boost economic growth and connect people to the global economy. If we can do all that, if we accelerate our progress and focus on key turnarounds, we believe we can all but wipe out extreme poverty within the next 15 years.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.